Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument for petitioners in Sage Street Associates versus Northdale Construction.
May it please the court. The study notice is David Harper, the largest petitioner. The notice of
May I please support? This is a construction contract dispute in which the petitioner Sage Street was found to have wrongfully terminated the respondent Northdale. The Court of Appeals affirmed a judgment against Sage Street for $2,491,110 in contract damages and awarded interest and attorney fees. That award included prejudgment interest at the rate of 10% compounded daily. I'll address the prejudgment interest question, and then Mr. Harvin will take about 5 minutes to address the contract damages issue. The issue before this court is whether the Article 16, Section 11 of the Texas Constitution limits the award of prejudgment interest in this case to 6%. The Constitution provides that in contracts where no rate of interest is agreed upon, the rate shall not exceed 6%. The language is plain. The only question could possibly be whether interest, as used in the Constitution, includes the prejudgment interest awarded in this case. And the answer is that it does. The same section of the Constitution that sets that maximum rate authorizes the legislature to define interest. The legislature has defined interest as the compensation allowed by law for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. If there was ever any question that that definition was limited to a loan rate, this court apparently settled that last November in Briones versus Solomon. The issue there was whether post-judgment interest was interest for purposes of the usury statute, Title 79. This court answered that question in the affirmative, reasoning first that the definition of interest did not indicate any limitation to loan rates, and second, that including post-judgment interest within that definition is consistent with this court's definition of prejudgment interest as the compensation allowed by law for the use or detention of money. Thus, it seems apparent that the word interest in the Constitution encompasses prejudgment interest as awarded in this case. Apparently, the only court of appeals to have recognized this constitutional limitation is the first court of appeals in Houston. That court in Olson versus Balin Publishing held that in a contract case involving unascertainable damages, although Article 5069.1.03, which applies to contracts with ascertainable damages, did not apply, the Constitution limited the award of prejudgment interest to 6%. This court denied the writ in that case. In Houston now, we're faced with the situation where if a case goes up on appeal to the first court, whether or not the damages are ascertainable in the contract case, the court is going to limit the award of prejudgment interest to 6% pursuant to the Texas Constitution. If the case goes up to the 14th Court of Appeals, there's still an issue whether prejudgment interest is going to be 6% under Article 5069.103 or 10% under Kavanaugh and Perry Roofing. It's pure happenstance whether a litigant's case goes up to the first court or the 14th court in Houston. Recognizing the constitutional limitation as it applies to this case and to all contracts, whether or not the damage is ascertained as unpayable, will serve several policy interests to this state. First, it will end the forced and artificial distinction which this court attempted to end in Kavanaugh. Previously, the forced and artificial distinction between cases involving ascertainable and unascertainable damages served to determine whether a litigant received prejudgment interest or did not receive prejudgment interest. That question has now been settled. However, in contract cases, this same artificial distinction remains to determine whether a litigant will receive interest at the rate of 6% or at the higher rate of at least 10%. There's no logical rationale for this distinction, but it remains, and it forces the party to litigate the issue of whether the damages are ascertainable in every contract case. The second policy interest that will serve is to restore equity and symmetry to the law. We now have a situation where one party to a contract may be able to obtain prejudgment interest at the higher 10% rate, while the other party to the contract may be limited to 6% prejudgment interest, depending on the manner of the breach and the type of damages that are suffered by the plaintiff in the case. Limiting the award of prejudgment interest to 6%, whether or not the damages are ascertainable, thus will ensure that both parties to the contract who come into the contract voluntarily, have equal bargaining power, are treated the same if they should get to the court. And finally, it will uphold the interests of the state as expressed by both the Constitution and the legislature that when the parties to a contract have not agreed on an interest rate, that rate should not exceed 6%.
Now, the contract between Sage Street and Arkville didn't specifically charge interest, did it?
No, it did not. It includes a provision in the AIA general conditions that states that if the parties don't agree on a rate of interest, the legal rate shall apply. That merely restates the law. The parties here did not agree on a rate of interest, and so the legal rate should apply. So the question is that legal rate, Article 50691.03, 6%, which calls itself the legal rate? Unfortunately, the case law in the state right now says that, well, if the damages are not ascertainable, that rate doesn't apply. And so while the parties may seem to have agreed on an interest rate of 6%, because of the case law in this state, they're forced to litigate what that rate of interest should be. Recognizing the constitutional limitation will eliminate that unnecessary litigation.
Sage Street didn't pay Arkville any interest as performance under the contract.
When payments were made during the construction of the contract, payments were made timely, and so no interest was charged or necessary. The question now is whether, assuming that damages are ultimately upheld against Sage Street, which we hope they will not be, the damages awarded under the contract should bear interest at the rate of 6% or the rate of 10%.
The usury laws that you were referring to earlier provide penalties for those who contract or charge or receive interest greater than the lawful amount. How do they apply to judgments which can come about only as the action of the court?
That issue has been before the court and is before it now. The court held in Briones v. Solomon, a case that hasn't yet been reported in the Southwest Reporter, that a demand for judgment interest was subject to the usury law if that demand was for excess interest. The court currently has before it the case of George A. Fuller v. Carpet Services, in which the question is whether a pleading that demands prejudgment interest during a time which should be interest-free is subject to the usury penalty. I won't hazard a prediction as to how the court will come out on that. But recognizing the constitutional limitation, I think, will eliminate at least one of the traps for the unwary in pleading for prejudgment interest. If it is clear that in contract cases, prejudgment interest can never exceed 6% unless the parties have agreed to some higher lawful rate, then there is no danger of pleading for excess interest because all parties will know that the interest rate is 6%. Now there's some confusion, and parties who plead for prejudgment interest at the rate of 10% may be subject to a usury counterclaim by a party who contends that interest should be limited to 6%. In this particular case, usury is not an issue. The only question is whether the prejudgment interest awarded by the court should be limited to 6% or 10%.
In terms of the public policy considerations that you advanced, since this interest arises from action of the court, and we have developed through the common law and case law the law concerning prejudgment interest, isn't it better to continue to do it that way than to rely on statute, than to base it on statutory law?
I think the answer to that is that we don't need to base it on statutory law because the Constitution speaks to this. If the current scheme remains in place, where some contract plaintiffs are allowed only 6% and other contract plaintiffs are allowed 10% or more, this court and all courts will continue to see the question of whether the damages in the case are ascertainable or unascertainable and what the rate of prejudgment interest ought to be. The Constitution has clearly limited that to 6%, and recognizing that limitation will eliminate that unnecessary litigation. If I may, I'd like to turn the podium over to Mr. Harvin now, who will speak to contract damages, and I'll do that for rebuttal.
May it please the court, there is no doubt that this prejudgment interest question is intellectually interesting, but it is not the most serious problem in the Court of Appeals' opinion. The most serious error is the holding on damages. Judge Pressler held that Northdale was entitled to recover the full contract price, even though by its own admission it did not fully complete the work. You will find no Texas case that reaches that result and that supports that holding.
Would you get right to the allegation that you waived that complaint?
Judge Phillips, there is no question that we are bound by the issue as submitted. But here is the point. The Court of Appeals is also bound by that same issue. And that issue was phrased in terms of what sum of money is due to Northdale under the contract for the work it performed. And I want to stop right there. For the work it performed. There is no way under either the party's contract or the law that a contractor can recover the full contract price for less than full completion of the work. So the question, which we accept, which we are bound with, the Court of Appeals is also bound to, and it wholly ignored that in going off on this tangent. The law is clear that even a wrongfully terminated contractor can only recover for the work he actually did, plus the profit he would have made had he been allowed to complete the contract.
Under the Court of Appeals theory, the owner would be required to pay the damages plus still pay to complete the project. Is that correct?
That's correct. I see what you mean. Yes. The Court of Appeals theory is that the owner pays the full contract price.
But the contract price includes the cost of completing the work.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. The court said it was going to try to put the contractor in the position he would have been in had he been allowed to complete the work.
That would mean that you would deduct the cost of completing the project. Is that correct?
Precisely. The only way you can earn the full contract price is to spend the money necessary to complete the project. So if you want to know where you are at that point, you have to deduct the cost to complete from the full contract price.
The way the Court of Appeals opinion reads, if you walk off the job on the first day, you're entitled to the full contract price. You're wrongfully discharged.
That's exactly right. Even if it's a $4 million contract and you've only done $100,000 of the work, that is exactly the import of Judge Pressler. And I would submit to you, you can't find any authority for that. The most eloquent statement about this is the total failure of the respondents to support Judge Pressler's position. They do not argue that he was correct. They do not argue that they were entitled to the full contract price. Instead, they say, well, there's some other theories that will support this finding. And those are set forth in their papers. One theory is, well, we spent $13 million, but we only paid $11 million. And in addition, we're entitled to a fee of $760,000. Other theory is, well, we performed 92% of the work, so we're entitled to 92% of the contract amount, which includes the $13,535,000 maximum contract price, change orders, and they say this fee on top of the contract. There are two insuperable problems with each of those theories. First, as a matter of law, this fee is not on top of the $13,535,000. That is a legal question, a question of interpretation of the contract. If you look at the contract, we set out all the provisions in some detail in our brief. The fee is within and subject to this guaranteed maximum cap. Without that fee on top of the $13 million, there is no way that the respondents can get to the amount found by the jury under either of their alternate theories. They have to have that fee on top of the contract amount to get there. That's fatal error number one. The second error in both of these is the subject of interest. The court ignored the fact that in addition to paying Northdale its $11 million, Sage Street also paid to Northdale's subcontractors $1.2 million in retainage. In a normal case, that is money that would have been paid to Northdale for payment on to the subcontractor. Because of the termination here, Sage Street paid the money directly to the subcontractor. Now, if we had to go out and pay the money twice, that is, now pay it also to Northdale, we would have paid that retainage twice, which is uncalled for under the contract or under the law. At trial, the president of Northdale admitted on the stand that he was not seeking to recover the retainage in this case. It seems to me that that is a pretty clear indication of the circumstance we have here that it would be unfair to allow that to be recovered twice. Thank you.
Was this a Miller-McGregor-Hardeman Act? What time?
Oh, Judge, you've gone beyond my capability there. This is a HUD financing project.
Okay, but the statutory lien was created under what statute?
I do not know.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court,
my client is Northdale Construction Company. The other two respondents in this case are Federal Insurance Corporation and the FDIC. Counsel for both of those two respondents have graciously allowed me the honor of taking up all of our time before you today. We are all represented by different clients, so we have filed always joint briefs before this court. The petitioners have chosen, as they had a right to do, to address points of error raised in their brief that are not points that this court granted writ upon. I want you to know that I am prepared to address those issues, but I would prefer to spend the majority of my time on the prejudgment interest issues, because that's the issue the court expressed an interest in, and reserve whatever time is left to discuss the issues according to have to do with the judgment proper. There's one point that I really want to get across today, so I'm going to start with that point. And that point is, there has never been award of prejudgment interest based upon the statute, section 5069.1.03, and its predecessors. And its predecessors began in 1840 with the Republic of Texas. Awards granted under this statute and awards of prejudgment interest granted by the court under the common law as an element of damage have never been exclusive remedies. The concept and the basic underlying principle in all the cases that award prejudgment interest, whether they're awarding prejudgment interest under the statute or as an element of damages under the common law, has always been the same basic concept. And it's the same basic concept that this court adopted, unanimously adopted and revitalized and beefed up a little bit in Kavanaugh. And that concept is that a plaintiff is not adequately compensated for his injury unless he is also awarded the fair market value, a fair market rate of return on the money that has been wrongfully withheld from him. To illustrate this and to show that this has been...
It's 10%, just as an aside, is that a fair market rate right now?
The rate that is set in 1.05 fluctuates with the market rate, and it sets a minimum of 10%. That is still a proper rate under other to apply in all cases, because as the Court of Kavanaugh recognized, the award of prejudgment interest is also bounded upon other policy considerations.
But I mean, it's not just adequate compensation. I
amount.
Yeah, well, it's not just that.
6 or 7% above the current federal discount rate is not.
Right, but also in Kavanaugh, the considerations for picking, by analogy, 1.05 over 1.03 was that it would also serve to expedite settlement and to and trial, and it still serves that purpose for sure. The cases that I really urge the court to look back at to verify what I'm trying to tell you now. The first that I would like you to take a close look at is Watkins v. Junker. It's an 1897 case that's discussed in both Kavanaugh and this court's opinions in Phillips Petroleum v. Stahl, which also takes a historical view and look at what prejudgment interest is founded upon. In Watkins v. Junker, the court states that interest as damages may be allowed on unliquidated demands, whether they arise out of breach of contract or out of tort. Same basic policy applies to tort and any kind of claim in which the defendant, well, almost all claims in which the defendant has been wrongfully, the plaintiff has been wrongfully kept from having the money of his owed. The court goes on to say, this is because in all cases where the measure of damages is fixed by the conditions existing at the time of the injury is inflicted, the person entitled to recovery has also the right to have compensation for the detention of the money to which he is entitled by reason of the wrong done to him.
But how can you avoid the fairly plain language of the Constitution?
The plain language of the Constitution, when you're interpreting what is the plain language of the Constitution, I think it's important to go back again to history and look at the Constitution as it was first, the usury and legal rate provisions were first inserted in the Constitution in 1870s or so. Before Reconstruction, there had never been any kind of constitutional provision that allowed or had anything to do with usury or a legal rate. It was all based on statutes, and those statutes began in 1840. During Reconstruction, the Reconstruction government, the theory was that usury impedes commerce, and all usury law should be abolished, and the Constitution provided that. There are great credit abuses in the Reconstruction era and afterwards, and the people of Texas decided we want our usury laws back, and we want them back for good, so they put them into the Constitution. And then the legislature passed new usury laws under that Constitution that reenacted essentially the same usury laws that had been enacted by the Republic in 1840. Some of those, the language has been tinkered with some. The legislature has made some changes about prejudgment interest that have confused matters some. But basically, the same, so when you're interpreting the constitutional provision that includes the language that says specifically, in contracts where no rate of interest is agreed upon, the rate shall not exceed 6% per annum. That needs to be, that provision allows and provides for the maximum amount of interest that a party can charge directly another party in absence of a specific agreement specifying a specific rate. The Constitution provision in no way is intended to limit what the court can award to a plaintiff as an element of its damages under the common law. I hope that answers your question.
So your theory is under the Constitution, even though no party to a contract could charge another party more than 6%, the court could award whatever number it felt like it ought to award?
The court can award, that's correct. The court can award a plaintiff, whether it's under a contract action or under a tort action or action for conversion or action for property damage, an action for common carrier, messing up your goods in transit, all these situations are situations in which, in the early cases, prejudgment interest was awarded as a writer of right, whether there's a contract action or not a contract action.
So under your theory, not even the statutes limit the prejudgment interest that should be awarded in this case?
The statute also does not limit the prejudgment interest awarded in the case, because the prejudgment interest is also allowed by the common law as an element of damages. And the court in common law can assign an element of damages. There have lots of situations in which a plaintiff has a choice between a common law remedy and a statutory remedy. And when there is a choice, the courts have always allowed, especially in Southwestern Bell's case, the plaintiff to elect the remedy that gives them the best recovery. And the trial court has a duty to write the judgment to give them the best recovery. The second case I really want the court to take a look at, and unfortunately I have not cited, is Federal Life Insurance Company versus Chrisson. It is at 249 Southwest 193. It's a 1923 case. I have not yet cited it, but this court has cited it in several cases. It cited it in Kavanaugh, I believe it cited it in, no, it cited it in Phillips Petroleum, and it cited it in Rio Grande. And it cited it in a case that the petitioners rely upon, the this case is important because it is the first case in which the Supreme Court has defined the term a sum contract ascertaining the sum payable. And it defined the term because of a procedural question of whether or not the Court of Civil Appeals had jurisdiction over the action. All of these cases, the early cases that try to seek to define the term ascertaining the sum contract ascertaining the sum payable, arose out of procedural questions that have nothing to do with the basic policy behind awarding a plaintiff what he's sufficient compensation for the damages he suffered because he has been denied his money. In that case, the court defined a contract ascertaining the sum payable so broadly that it encompasses the same criteria that the courts mention when it awards interest as damages under the common law. And the court acknowledged that specifically after it goes through its various ways of explaining what this term means in the contract. The court says interest would follow regardless of the statute, or it follows by reason of the statute. Interest would follow regardless of the statute, or it follows by reason of the statute. In other words, the plaintiff is allowed to get its prejudgment interest either as an element of damages under the common law or under the statute. And it has never made a difference until the confusion after Perry Roofing, whether the contract was a contract based on 1.03, the claim was based on 1.03, or the claim was based on 1.06, under the common law, sorry. When considering these points, I would like the court to also reconsider and keep in mind the basic concepts and things that were the basis for part of the opinion in Kavanaugh. And those basic concepts that I would like the court to keep in mind are these. Prejudgment interest that approximates the market rate comes closest to achieving the full compensation. Kavanaugh also held that a plaintiff is justified, the reason a court in modified prejudgment interest law was not as the counsel petitioner has indicated. The reason, the only thing that Kavanaugh tinkered with or changed in the law of what allowed in the common law for prejudgment interest was the rule that was established in the early cases that you don't get prejudgment interest unless you can show the court that you're entitled to this amount of money at this particular date. Kavanaugh said, in personal injury cases, you're not always able to say, I was owed this amount of money at this particular date because my injury and my harm from being hurt in this car wreck happened over a long period of time. And that had been the original reason for denying prejudgment interest in the earlier cases, in personal injury cases. This court did not the inequity that was resolved in Kavanaugh was the inequity in denying those kinds of plaintiffs prejudgment interest as opposed to other kinds of plaintiffs. I acknowledge that several courts of appeals have read Perry Roofing and Rio Grande Cattle and Light Company as saying that if interest can be allowed under Article 5069.1.03, then it cannot be allowed under the common law. And I respectfully submit that that is not a reasonable basis for making a distinction. It creates new inequities. It creates an inequity between a person that happens to have cited the statutory right to prejudgment interest, although he could have equally brought his claim under the common law.
I would like to ask you a question in the area of damages.
Okay.
The question submitted was that Northdale should be allowed to recover for the work it performed, its overhead, and its profit.
Yes, it did.
The problem comes in headnote 5 in the CA opinion on page 778, which says to put Northdale in the position it would have occupied had it been allowed to complete the contract, it should receive the contract price minus the money it received plus any amounts owed and spent on change orders. Okay. That means, or am I correct or incorrect, does that mean that the cost of completing the job also has to be paid?
No, Your Honor, it does not mean that. And one important fact that the court, the petitioners don't like to emphasize is that this is a contract that is a, let me get this term right, it is a cost plus contract. The construction, the contractor is entitled to reimbursement of all his costs up to a maximum. And the maximum was never reached because they kicked Northdale off the job before he was able to complete his contract. If you compare the trial court submission, to which there was no objection, and to which there was never an objection that you are submitting the wrong measure of damages, approximates the kinds of damages that it uses the same essential terms that are used in, I think it's paragraph 14 of the contract. And that paragraph concerned what kind of damages are allowed a contractor if he has to leave the job because the owner has not paying him and not filling his compensation. We didn't have to leave the job for that. We were kicked off the job. But in essence, it says this is what a contractor gets when it's the other guy's fault. And that...
Do you agree that a person who is wrongfully discharged should not be allowed to recover the cost of completing the job?
I agree that that is the basic Hornbook law in fixed lump sum contracts. I do not agree that that is the basic Hornbook law in cost plus contracts, where the contractor is allowed, is entitled to recover his cost plus a fee. And that makes the only dispute about, okay, is that fee, $750,000 fee on top. And that is an excessive claim. It is not a claim of no evidence, and it is not a claim that this court has jurisdiction over. And if you look very, another point I would like to make on that is this. This court is supposed to only correct errors in the judgment. And there is no error in the judgment. And there's no error in the fact that the court overruled the points of error that Faith Street raised. All the points of error that Faith Street raised were no evidence and insufficient evidence points of error under which they tried to bring up this theory that the wrong measure of damages was applied. But they waived the theory that the wrong measure of damages was applied by the court because they failed to object to the charge and failed to commit the measure of damages that they claim is the correct measure.
Any other questions?
Did the court, the CA, correctly state the measure of damages in its opinion?
I have to look back at the exact language. But there is no error in awarding Northfield its cost up to the date and the awarding the work that it had done and the fee and the profit and overhead that were allowed in the contract, which is essentially the way the issue was framed. Because up until that point, the maximum cost is the maximum price contract had never been reached.
I understand. It's just the wording.
Right.
Five.
Well, I think that the wording in the opinion might be confusing and not applicable in many other situations. But it is not an error in the judgment. It is error in a footnote, which is not, I would hope, error that the court sees fit to mess with right now.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The argument upon which respondents now rely on the prejudgment interest issue is a new argument in this case. It was set forth for the first time in their supplemental brief filed last week. Moreover, it's contrary to the arguments they set forth in their opening brief, where they wrote that the legislature had imposed a 6% ceiling rate on contracts ascertaining income payable, and that Article 506.91.03 caps interest at 6% in cases where damages are ascertainable. They now argue that that is not true, that that is an incorrect assumption. Moreover, it's contrary to what this court has ruled. In Perry Roofing, the court, in discussing the fiberglass insulators case, noted that fiberglass insulators involved a claim for contractual damages that were clearly ascertainable, and therefore 506.91.03 controlled. The scheme that respondents suggest would have the court nullify the clear intent of the legislature in 506.91.03 in awarding higher equitable prejudgment interest in all contract cases. Further, as the court has noted, depending on the economic situation at a given time, one statute or another may come much closer to making the plaintiff whole. Now, 6% is adequate, more than adequate, to make a plaintiff whole for the use of their money.
Before you move on to your next point, you mentioned, Ms. Owens, the carpet services case earlier.
Yeah.
And, of course, have referenced in your brief the San Jacinto Savings case from out of Houston.
Yes.
If those courts of appeals are correct in their holdings, how does that affect your analysis in this case?
in their holding that a pleading cannot be a charge of prejudgment interest. I don't think it affects our analysis at all. I'm sorry?
They're holding that a pleading cannot constitute a charging of usurious interest.
Yes, I think I don't think that affects our analysis at all. I think that would be limited to the analysis that because the demand for interest is contained in a pleading, which is a document, an official document filed with the court, that cannot constitute a charge of interest. All we're concerned with here is the rate of interest that may be awarded in a contract case, which the Constitution, by its plain language, limits to 6% in all contracts, not just loan contracts. I'd like to turn briefly to contract damages and respond to a couple of points made by the respondent. First, it is incorrect to call this contract a cost-plus contract. The case law defines a cost-plus contract as a contract where the contractor recovers all of his expenses, no matter how high they are, plus a percentage of whatever those expenses may be. There are several cases cited in our reply brief which set that out very clearly. This contract was a guaranteed maximum price contract. There's a dispute about what that guaranteed maximum price is. It is either $13,535,000 or $13,535,000 plus $760,000 as overhead and profit. But it is not a cost-plus contract. In fact, Northdale conceded that it was not a cost-plus contract in their opening brief to the Court of Appeal. Second, the court is correct that the damage award, the measure of damages instituted by the Court of Appeals would require the owner in this case to pay the full contract price to the contractor, Northdale, and in addition, pay the cost to complete to the new contractor who was hired to complete the building. Thus, the contractor is forced to pay twice for the same amount of work. That is not the law, and it is not the party's contract, and it should not be the result of this case. I'd like to close on the prejudgment interest issue by saying that the Constitution, the statutes, and this court have all defined interest as the compensation allowed by law for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. That definition is not limited to interest in money lending. The definition includes prejudgment interest. It includes interest as used in Article 16, Section 11 of the Texas Constitution, which states that in contracts where no rate of interest is agreed upon, the rate shall not exceed 6%. And that definition should include the prejudgment interest awarded in this case. This court should recognize the limitation of the Constitution and hold that in all contract cases, whether or not damages are ascertainable, the rate of interest shall not exceed 6%. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the second clause. The court will now take another brief recess.